Our speaker, as was just mentioned in prayer, is Dr. Danny Carroll. He's the Distinguished Professor of Old Testament at Denver Theological Seminary in Denver, Colorado. He is a THM graduate from DTS. He is bilingual and bicultural, Guatemalan-American, who taught for many years in Central America before returning to the U.S. to assume his role as Professor of Old Testament Studies at Denver Seminary. He's the founder of a Spanish-speaking lay training program at the seminary and the author of Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible. And the second edition of that has just been released, and so it is now available. He's a board member of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference and its spokesman on immigration. Dr. Carroll and his wife Joan have been married for over 37 years. They have two grown married sons, Matthew and Adam, and are soon to be grandparents for the first time in December. Danny, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to come spend the week with us here for our missions and evangelism lectureship. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Danny Carroll?
Good morning. It's a joy to be here. In fact, my first seminary class, hi Elliot, how are you? Years ago, it was actually in this room. Lamb Auditorium was much more primitive in those days, and I was with Prof. Hendricks, and so it's great to be back here. You might ask yourself, what is an Old Testament prof doing in an Evangelism and Missions Week? I hope you're asking that question. It's a bit odd. And let me tell you why, and then I'll move into what I want to talk about for the week. My area is the prophets, especially the 8th century prophets. And that's about ethics, isn't it? If you think about Isaiah and Micah and Amos and Hosea, you're talking about ethics. I was many years in Guatemala teaching during the time of the war. And so, for the first time, I had to process theologically the nature of war and poverty and all the conflicts in Central America. And then when I come back to Denver, the issue of immigration. Now, that's kind of the professional side of it. In fact, I would say as an Old Testament guy, especially if you work in the prophets, you cannot think about the Bible except through the lens of ethics and through the mission of the church. You see, we are here to be a different kind of people. But there's also a personal side to it. As Mark was Dr. Bailey was mentioning. I can hear Daryl's laugh. Daryl and I go way back to elementary school. I'm hoping he doesn't introduce me this week because that could get embarrassing. But anyway, I am half Guatemalan, you see. No one believes that because I'm 6'6". But I am. I have an older brother. He's 5'6". So there's genetic failure there somewhere. But I actually have two surnames. In Latin America, you have two surnames. If you're a male, your second last name is your mother's maiden name. So I'm actually Danny Carroll Rodas. So my Guatemalan side, my Guatemalidad, means a lot to me. And as I moved to Denver from Central America, I began to listen to the issues of immigration really for the first time. Growing up in Houston, we had friends who were Latins, but they were Cuban Americans, and so we didn't really engage the immigration debate. I don't know if you know anything about immigration, but the Cubans have a special dispensation. If they touch U.S. soil, they're legal. And I think this is just to kind of you know, to give the old oomph to Fidel Castro in Cuba. So the legality piece never came up. My mother, of course, was married to an American, and so that it never came up. And our neighbors for many years were my Guatemalan aunt and uncle. And he was a Texas A&M grad, an engineer. And so, again, never came up. And then I went to work in Latin America for about 15 years, and of course, you're in Latin America, so it's not an issue. Then I come to Denver, and for the first time, I begin to engage the conversations. We began an Hispanic lay training ministry at the seminary. We have over 100 students, every semester, and I began to hear the stories. So now I attend an Hispanic church. I'm involved with Hispanic things in the city and nationally. So it's not only the professional piece where the Old Testament drives me to the questions of ethics, of war and poverty and migration. It's also something very personal. See, I'm half Guatemalan, and esta es mi gente. These are my people. And so as I work in immigration, it is not just for professional reasons, it's for deeply, deeply personal reasons. And this week, what I want to talk about is migration. And this is a very complicated, touchy, and emotional subject. But if we can't talk about it in our seminaries, where can we talk about it? If we can't have good arguments about this in our seminaries, where can we do it? So I'm going to give you my perspective this week on immigration. Today I'm going to talk about where we begin. Tomorrow I'll just go through Old Testament stories of migration, and you'll be surprised just how full the Old Testament is of migration stories and how it echoes the experiences of immigrants today. On Thursday, we'll go to Old Testament law and ask ourselves, in the ancient world where there was migration as well, how did Israel respond? How did it meet the needs of those who had come in? Is there anything that that might teach us as we ponder immigration reform in this country? And then Friday, we'll try to wrap it up with thinking how the world migration phenomenon might be changing the whole discussion on mission and missions. See, I want to begin to think about framing the conversation in a different way. And I want to frame it missionally. For some reason, I actually did put a Y on that. I think the guys in the back misspelled my word. But trust me, there is a Y on the end of that word. The history of humanity is the history of migration, large and small. Short distances, long distances, crossing continents and oceans, during times of peace and also times of war. Migration is in our DNA as human beings. If we think about it, in the creation account, we're told to multiply and to fill the earth. You see, you do that by moving. If you think about the Tower of Babel, humanity is dispersed by force. You see, we've been on the move ever since Eden. The movement of humanity is the nature of history itself. This is who we are. Now, today, the United Nations estimates that about 215 million people are on the move today. Whether crossing borders or moving within their own borders. I looked up some statistics, these are from 2010. The foreign-born population in Western Europe is now over 12%, in this country over 13%. And in many countries, including this one, it's the immigrant population that's growing the fastest. You see, the demographics, the profile of this country and many others around the world is changing before our very eyes. Now, this has been the history of humanity, as I've said, because of war, natural disasters, hunger, lack of work, persecution, political oppression, racial profiling. What is new is not the movement. What is new is the sheer size of the movement. The numbers are overwhelming. We've never seen these kinds of numbers before. So it's not surprising around the world, and on Thursday, I'll give you some examples from Australia and Dominican Republic that have been very recent. With this massive arrival of those from the outside, it's not surprising that the host countries around the world feel threatened and they're worried. All kinds of mixed feelings about those who have come. Let me show you a slide. I don't know if you can see that very well. This is from the 1890s. There is the classic mixed message. You see, there's the column that says, United States of America, admittance free, welcome, come on in. But there's Uncle Sam at the doorway, holding his nose. Isn't that the mixed message? Oh, this is a nation of immigrants, but we're suspicious. Look at the profile of the immigrant, the caricature, probably an Eastern European Jew. And what does the immigrant carry? Well, the thing that people always say they carry, poverty in one hand and disease in another. You can see it's 19th century because the other thing he carries on his back is Sabbath desecration. I don't think that's really bothering people very much anymore. But also in the smaller barrel on his back is anarchy. See, immigrants are perceived to be a threat to national identity, a cultural mores, societal infrastructure, ecological integrity, and economic stability. So it's not surprising, again, that the kind of discussion you hear in this country and around the world has to do about legality and border security. That's where it'll go naturally, and that's where it's gone. So now the debates are about... They change my spelling and they give me a light show. So the debates center on quotas, establishing kind of firm filters at the border for access, more sophisticated vigilance, harsher penalties for violations. And they question about any kind of connections to terrorism. So in this kind of environment, what would be a particularly Christian point of view? Now, what got me into this whole debate a number of years ago was I would have conversations with Christians. It was the same kind of conversation I would have with non-Christians. It was about the economics, the crowded schools, hospital, emergency rooms. It was about Hispanic gangs. These are all pragmatic things that you need to get to, and we'll get to them on Thursday. But there was nothing explicitly Christian about the conversation. The conversation I was having with confessing Christians was exactly the same as those who had no Christian faith at all. So that becomes the question. What would be an explicitly Christian view on immigration, deeply grounded in the Bible, and put within the framework of the mission of the church? Now, we got to get to the pragmatics of immigration, but the question is, how do we get to those questions? What would be the Christian perspective to address those issues? You see, in light of over 200 million people migrating worldwide, the question should be, what does it mean to be the church? With over 200 million people migrating worldwide, the question should be, what does it mean to be a Christian? So you've changed the conversation. They're not just national issues. They're deeply missiological. They're also about Christian identity itself. Now, worldwide, the Christian church is becoming aware of this. Migration now is a major topic of mission studies, as Mike would know. The Lausanne Statement, the Seoul Declaration on Diaspora Missiology, 2009. The Cape Town Commitment from 2010 is a section dedicated to migration. See, this is the world now, you see. A world of migrating populations, of diaspora communities. Now, as we talk about these things, it's not just a discussion about mission to immigrants. It's not only about insights about immigrants, because that makes them the target of study, you see. And that's okay up to a point. But what I'm going to try to push us this week to think about is, what can we learn from them? Biblically, theologically, pastorally, how do we engage interculturally and missiologically the diaspora and migration phenomenon that is going around all over the world? Now, I use this illustration with my students at Denver Seminary. Mike, you're not introducing me again for the rest of the week. I use this illustration. And Daryl would know this. Do I have to address you like Dr. Bach from up here? Okay, all right. I just saw Daryl this weekend. My younger son got married, so Daryl was with us this weekend, so that was good. But I've worn glasses since I was little. In fact, in high school even, I had to wear bifocals. Now, if you're like a high school senior and wearing bifocals, and back then you had the line across, it was like not cool. But I had to have the bifocals. And so I've had them for all these years. And of course, as years go by, your eyes get worse, right? The nice thing as a professor is at least they pay you for this. Right? So you read books and your eyes get worse, but you're getting a paycheck. So that kind of softens the blow. But about 7 or 8 years ago, I began to notice as I would work on my computer, I was doing this. You ever done this? And so I go to the optometrist and she says, you know, you really need like trifocals. Or like the progressive lens thing. Or what we could do is do like two sets of glasses, right? One for the computer and one for the other stuff. So let me do that. So for a couple of years, I did that. See, I'd be working at my desk at the seminary and I'd be knock on the door and I'd have to, you know, change my glasses and, okay. But now I'm on the progressive lenses. But here's my point. See, if I take these glasses off, I can see everyone in this room. I can even see the clock in the back of the room. But even here on the front row, it's blurred. I can maybe see the color of your shirt. I kind of can tell if you're male or female. Hair, no hair, I can do that. See, I see you, but what I don't have is a way of seeing you clearly. Now, when we think about immigration, this is precisely the point. Everyone out there sees it. Everyone out there has an opinion. See, the question is, do they see it clearly? Do they have the biblical lens to engage all the multiple issues and the realities of immigrants? Or is it from a distance, the abstract concept, with all the pragmatics that are involved, but do they see it with God's lens? So this week, I want to redirect the conversation. And this morning, I want to talk about two foundational biblical themes. And the first one will be based on Genesis 1. And so I know that you guys are Dallas Seminary, you have your Bibles, but I've actually brought the text with me, and at least they haven't changed the wording in this one. Because when I want to talk about immigration, I want to begin at the beginning. Genesis chapter 1, page 1, the creation of humankind. And the text says that every person is created in the image of God, and that includes immigrants. And for some, this may seem basic and overly simplistic, but it's actually very crucial. Because what happens is you begin to hear the media, talk radio, and some of the news channels. This is the kind of language they use about immigrants. Invading horde, tidal wave, aliens. We use that for outer space creatures. When does an alien become a human being? We use derogatory language about, illegals and lawbreakers. We talk about those people. Many occupy low-wage earning jobs, live in poor neighborhoods. They tend to congregate in their own little enclaves. It's very natural. People think they're uneducated, uncultured in comparison with the host culture. And all of this reinforces the negative perception of the other, and we marginalize them. So the national conversation tends to start with and get stuck on the issues of legality. Do they have the proper piece of paper? But if you start with legality, you don't have a conversation because you either have your papers or you don't. There's no discussion. It's done. So I want to begin somewhere else. It's not that you ignore the legal piece, but you just don't begin there. You get there, but you don't begin there. I would suggest to you that we begin not with their legality, but with their humanity. Because if we begin with their humanity, when we get to the legal piece, it'll be a different kind of conversation. The tone will be different. The direction will be different. And you'll see that in just a moment. You see, they're made in the image of God. Now, you can talk about the image in a couple of ways. And here at Dallas, I know you would know these things. We can talk about the image of God in an ontological sense. This is who they are and what they have. A mind, emotions, a will, a spiritual side, a soul, you see. And this gives them incalculable worth in the sight of God and should give them incalculable worth in our sight as well. The fact that Jesus came and loves all people, even them, and gave his life for them also reinforces just the worth of the immigrants. But the other one is the functional piece. Because if you look at the text, humans are called to subdue the earth and have to be in dominion over the other creatures. And we see this in chapter 2 when the man is naming the creatures. And you know these things from your Old Testament survey classes. The ancient world, the king, if he was the head of a large territory, he would, you know, put images of himself out there so they would see him, at least in stone, and know that he was in control of that faraway land. See, we are in the image of God. We're his representatives, not of stone, but of flesh and blood, not of a dead rock, but of living human beings. But now we're talking about the potential to subdue and to have dominion over the earth. We are to be his vice regents. Now, what if we applied that to immigrants? See, it's not only that they have this ontological worth because they are made in the image of God, but all that would carry with it. But now you begin to appreciate that they have incredible potential. See, they can subdue the earth. They can have dominion over the earth. And now you're not talking about immigrants being kind of an unwelcome weight on society, but now the conversation begins to change because now you begin to process, how can they contribute to the common good? How can we facilitate their becoming all that God can have them to be? Let me show you how this works in law. Some of you may know or have heard of the Dream Act. And the idea was to give the young people who've been brought by their parents some kind of pathway to legal status, to help them with their education. Now, if you have this functional view of the image of God, this makes common sense. How do we facilitate the potential of all these hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young people that came, not because of any choice of their own? How can we kind of gear them and direct them so that they can help the country and contribute to us? You see, it's a common sense kind of idea coming out of the image of God. Now, do you see how you've changed the whole legal and legislation discussion? Now it's not about being punitive. Now it's not being about punishing and restricting. Now the legislation becomes facilitating, harnessing for the common good. Everything's changed because you've begun in a different place. You see, migration is about people, not just abstract legal status. Now, what I've seen as I travel the country and talk in all kinds of venues and seminaries and universities and denominational meetings and of every kind of denomination you can think of, with also with Catholics and Jews, see, the leadership understands this. They understand all this church planning that's going on. They're understanding the need to train leaders and to integrate the immigrants into the life of the church. Sadly, in the pews, it's not always met with acceptance. So the person in the pew often will be negative toward the outsider. But let's just say that you're an immigrant and you hear this. You see, they begin to see that they're not less than you. That they're not inferior, no matter how you treat them. They don't have to live with shame about who they are, but the color of their skin and their accent. They begin to recognize that they have worth and aptitude, that they can help this country. And now their ethnicity and their experience are something that you see as a wonderful provision of God. And now they can begin to understand how they can participate in the Missio Dei. And I can be proud of my Guatemalidad. Porque yo soy bilingüe, usted. Y si ustedes quieren, yo hablo en español con mucho gusto y sin pena. And I can go back to English and I can go back to Spanish like this. And I'm proud of being half Guatemalan. Yo soy medio chapín, ustedes. Y soy orgulloso de eso. Everything's changed. Because we began somewhere else. Not only for the host culture that receives, but also for those who have come. I was in Tijuana in July with InterVarsity. On the Tijuana side, Mexican university students had come and Americans had come. And the Americans, it was interesting, it was out of California, so it made sense. You know, half of them were Asian American and half were Hispanic American. And out of a group of 25, two were Anglos. And so, you know, they asked me to speak on immigration in the Bible, so I did. But the Mexicans were actually working through the mechanics of the immigration because they had family that had come. But these 1.5 and Generation 2 immigrant kids, they weren't thinking about immigration. They were trying to figure out who they were. And was being Asian something of shame? One woman said, "How Asian do I have to be Asian and still an American?" Let's just begin the conversation somewhere else. Second thing is I'm watching the clock, and I'm sure the chaplain is too. This is my shortest point. The second thing I want to mention is this, and I want you to listen carefully. Because when we go to the New Testament, and we see it in the Old in different ways, migration becomes a central metaphor for what it means to be a Christian. We are strangers in a strange land, we are told. See, we have a different king, a different set of values. We're an odd people. We gather at least once a week and sing songs and pray. We should have different kinds of families and do different kinds of work. Some things we won't do. And if we do get into a profession, we should have a different set of values, you see. We are strangers in a strange land. The problem with us many times is that this place is no longer strange. We rather like it. And we want to keep the strangers out. Do you see how everything's gone twisted? We've lost the strangeness. And we defend the strangeness and call them the strangers. You see, I'm going to throw something out at you, and if you don't agree with me, that's okay. I want the Spirit to engage you with the Word. I would suggest to you that the more you understand about immigration, the more you will understand what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be dependent, what it means to be odd, what it means to be marginalized, what it means to have no papers, what it means when people treat you differently. See, they know what it means. See, for us, it's just a metaphor. For them, it is life. And the more we understand and engage the immigration discussion, we will understand what it means to be a Christian. And the more you get to understand and get to know personally some immigrants, they will teach you what it means to be a Christian. When I speak in Hispanic churches, I tell them, nos necesitan. They need us. I would go further and say, nos necesitamos. We need each other. You see how the conversation's changing? Migration now becomes central, core to being a diaspora people, which all of us are. My time's up. It's not?
Oh, no, you can go till 11:30.
This keeps getting better all the time.
We need to be on our feet walking out by 11:30.
Okay. I can't do this, but I would love to do this right now. I'd love to have just a Q&A right now. But this is what I'm trying to move us toward. As you hear me speak, all kinds of red flags may go up. That's okay. I hope so. You may disagree with me. That's okay. I hope so. This may begin to change how you think about things. I hope so too. But as we move into the rest of the week, tomorrow we'll be looking at all the migration, not all, but some of the migration stories of the Old Testament. Let me give you one. I'm going to jump ahead because I've got a few more minutes. Just to give you a taste for tomorrow. Abram is called from Ur and he travels up to Haran, up to the northwest. He'll come down into Canaan. It's all very good, the first few verses of chapter 12. Of Genesis, he receives the promise. And he begins to move into the land and building altars and calling on the name of God. This is all very good, but then there's a famine in the land. And they go to Egypt. And we know from archaeology, the Egyptians had a series of forts on their eastern frontier to kind of monitor movement because they had water, they had the Nile, they had food, they had harvest, and people were always coming in to try to find food to eat. And as they get close to the border, maybe as they get close to one of these forts, Abram says, if they ask you, tell them you're my sister, not my wife. Why does he do that? Why is she willing to do that? Because they're hungry. And if it means lying to get across the border to feed your family, that's what you do. And if a woman has to risk her sexuality and her integrity so that her family can eat, she will do it. Just talk to them. Desperate people do desperate things. What's the alternative? To go back into the desert and die? You ever thought of Abram as an immigrant story? Maybe not. And it's just one of many. And that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. Thursday, the law, and then Friday, how this impacts the nature of mission itself as we move into the 21st century. So, wrapping it up. How do we talk about migration and immigration? Do we limit it to legal status? Is that the Christian argument? Is that as far as we go? I hope not. We'll get there. You know, in my Bible, Romans is about page 1200. It's amazing how much is before that. Why don't we let those 1200 pages inform how we read Romans 13? And maybe we'll read it differently. Let's begin with their humanity. Help us understand, oh God, that we need to understand migration to understand 1 Peter. That we may somehow understand what it means to be strange again. And tomorrow we'll see all these stories, amazing stories of God's people on the move. Can we pray? Father, thank you so much for this place. It's great to be back with friends that I've known for many, many years. It's great to be with these students. It's a complicated topic. Good arguments. That's fine. That's what seminaries are for. Give us wisdom. May your Spirit lead us into truth. May we have a heart that sees everyone around us as people. May you be pleased with us this week as we absorb and process your word for your glory and in your name. Amen.